2016 was a year in which the abuse of children was seldom out of the news, the reports of historical sexual abuse of young footballers being just the most recent example. Next year it'll be 10 years since the death of Peter Connolly, a 17-month-old who was found dead in his cot in North London. His mother and her boyfriend and his brother were later convicted of causing or allowing the death. Peter Connolly's identity was kept out of the public domain for some time, so he might be better known to you as Baby P. A serious case review that investigated what social workers, the police and GPs did found the practice of the majority, individually and collectively, was incompetent, and the baby's death could have been prevented. The death of Peter Connolly entered the political domain.
This is a story about a 17-year-old girl who had no idea how to bring up a child. It's about a boyfriend who couldn't read but could beat a child. And it's about a social services department that gets £100 million a year and can't look after children. That's what this is about.
Sharon Shoesmith was head of Haringey Social Services at the time of Peter Connolly's death. In December 2008, the then Secretary of State for Children, Ed Balls, announced he was using special powers to remove her from her post.
My first priority is to put in place a new leadership and management team in Haringey Children's Services. I have directed Haringey Council today to appoint Mr. John Coughlin as Director of Children's Services with immediate effect. And Haringey Council will now remove the current Director of Children's Services from her post with immediate effect.
Sharon Shoesmith was widely vilified in the news media. Two social workers who were sacked after Peter Connolly's death subsequently lost in their legal attempts to overturn their dismissals. But in 2011, the Court of Appeal ruled in favour of Sharon Shoesmith, who had argued that Ed Balls and Haringey Council acted unlawfully by sacking her. She received financial compensation for the unfair dismissal. Sharon Shoesmith has written a book, Learning from Baby P, based on a PhD she's completed. I've been talking to her about the book and first her experiences of being public enemy number one.
I'm watching this stuff on the television. I'm watching images of me at the top of the news. And I had to try and understand how we got to this place of the lies that were being told on reputable programmes, including the BBC, and how we'd all got caught up in this place. We got caught up in this whole culture of denying crimes against children and looking for someone else to blame. And of course, the social work profession are a very easy target, aren't they? And I was able to look at Ed Balls through that kind of lens. I was able to look at David Cameron. I mean, interestingly, people don't mention David Cameron, but in many ways it was his opportunism that kicked this whole thing
off. Well,
you go into that
in detail, and I'm going to go through the book chronologically because that makes most sense in terms of page turning. But what you just said about being at the start of the news, if your only experience of you, if you were a member of the public and Sharon Shoesmith was only what had been on the news and in the papers,
yes,
what would you think of her?
Oh, I could see why the public responded as they did. And I knew quite early on that there was absolutely no point in me trying to go in the media and counter this. It was just far too strong, far too potent, this story. I could understand why the public felt that way. But there was also a large proportion of people who beat a track to me to tell me that they didn't believe this, that this was, you know, distorted and so on. People who knew me, people who didn't know me. But overall, I would say if what the public was told was correct, they were absolutely perfectly entitled to behave as they did and to respond as they did.
Now, the backbone of the book is a PhD you did. Why do the book, though? I mean, I would have thought, you'll know better than me, but PhDs, if you wanted to make other people aware of the contents in sort of academic and social work circles, they can access that in that way, can't they? Or I just wonder why put yourself through this again? I mean, I watched you being interviewed by Piers Morgan when the book came out, and I did think, I just wonder, well, why is she putting herself through this? I mean, why would anyone put themselves through an interview with Piers Morgan? But why put yourself through it?
Why am I here today? I suppose I still feel very strongly that there is a really pressing need out there for people to understand crimes against children. Yeah. And that is really what drives me.
But are they likely to listen to you because of the stuff that's happened and because of your public persona? I'm not saying that they would be right to ignore you, but you've talked about what the public perception is of you. Are they more or less likely to listen to you because it's you?
I suppose the main audience for this book is the social work profession and other allied professions and others. There are others. And I, since the book was published, I've been up and down the country to universities speaking with social workers, student social workers, practicing social workers. And they are telling me that they have taken great strength from the book. And I suppose my main message to the social work profession is that there's only one set of people who can change this vilification of social workers, which is very, very embedded in our culture. And it is they themselves who have to take this on. And we've talked in some considerable depth, and I've run workshops and so on, about how the social work profession might begin to counter this, because I think it's absolutely vital that they do. There's not a social worker in the country who's been surprised that there's been child abuse within the football coaching regimes. But yet we don't talk about it. They are quiet about these things. I would never really have talked in any depth when I was director of children's services about children's social care and what the challenges were in a place like Haringey. I would never have done that. Because you just didn't have the confidence to do it. So this book is about, in many ways, empowering the social work profession. And it's they who I care about much more than that raft of public. Because I do think there's a lot of people out there in the public who do understand it.
Let's look at some of the things you've written. I was removed from my statutory position of Director of Education and Children's Social Care Services at a press conference by Ed Bowles, the Labour Secretary of State for Children, Schools and Families. The press conference was broadcast live on all major television stations and on websites. I watched the press conference and had had no warning that I was to be sacked live on air. What was that like?
Well, I don't think I spoke for about 2 days. I don't think I moved out of the chair I was in for that period as well. I was completely stunned. Utterly stunned. My daughters appeared from somewhere. To this day, I don't quite know from where. And of course, I was on a first floor apartment, and you know, the whole place was surrounded by media. By that, I mean like 100 tripods on the pavement.
Did you close the curtains?
Well, we were on the first floor. And I just stayed well back. Right. Yeah. In fact, I was to creep around that apartment for many, many, many months after that, and sometimes on hands and knees to cross the floor because of flashlights going off outside.
And was the doorbell ringing a lot, I presume?
Oh, yes.
And the phone
must have
been going.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. And there were complaints from the other people who lived in the block because they couldn't get the postman, couldn't get through. And it went on and on and on. And they stayed for, you know, a 4-month period. So large chunks of every day. They were there. And I developed, looking back, it feels quite irrational, but I developed an absolute, very deep fear of these people and used to shake. And for periods of time, I wouldn't be able to get out, or sometimes I got out and couldn't get in again. It was a shock, a real shock.
I wonder why your reaction wasn't stronger. Where was the fight if you felt, well, look, this is wrong?
I don't think anger was there, actually. I'm not actually given to be an angry person. Maybe that's a problem.
Well, no,
I'm not an angry person. I suppose my...
Sacked, humiliated.
Yeah. No, my route to it was trying to piece it together to understand. That's where I was. And I was in... So my head and my mind was sort of going into turmoil. And turbulence. These were the words. And no sleeping and utter confusion about what had happened. And beginning to doubt my role in it. You know, that was the very low time when I started to say, is there something here I don't understand? To my daughters, you know, tell me. So I was in a very confused place, and I had to, the fight to actually hold on to sanity was palpable. I can kind of recall what that felt like now. And, of course, I knew things like, you know, people will say a day at a time. Well, I was kind of in DNR at a time, literally, you know, do this, it'll be 11 o'clock, you know. Do this, it'll be midday, eat something. You know, that's where I was kind of for days and weeks at a time, yeah?
Later in the book, you talk about Rebecca Brooks. She admitted under questioning from her own lawyer, this was at Leveson.
Yeah.
She admitted under questioning from her own lawyer that she'd personally made a lot of mistakes in her 10 to 12 years as deputy editor and as editor at The Sun. And in that context, the balance went right out the window in attacks on social work leader Sharon Shoesmith, and the posting of a photographer outside my home was, quote, cruel, harsh, and over the top. What did it feel like to have those words fall from her lips?
Oh, my gosh. I suppose bit by bit, the story started to fall apart, didn't it? And no more so than this.
Did you watch that live? Did you see it?
Yeah.
What was it like?
In fact, I sat in the court and listened to a whole lot of the hacking trial. I sat in the court when she gave evidence and listened to her. I still had that very strong desire to understand where everybody came from on this, what it was they thought they were doing.
And when I'd you love heard to that, the person who'd ordered someone to go and stand outside your house saying it was cruel, harsh and over the top, how did that connect with you?
To some degree, I felt vindicated. You know, I began to get those sorts of feelings, you know, that people were beginning to see what this is. And this was a huge relief. Again, I wasn't angry at her. I'd love to meet Rebecca Brooks and actually talk to her about what was going on at that time. I'd love to meet Ed Balls. I've asked him. He won't meet me. I'd like to talk this through with people as to how they get caught up in this story. And really, you know, I say again that that's the whole motivation of the book, is the understanding and trying to put, because when I speak to social workers, what I don't do is make them angry. Yeah. They think I'm going to turn up and be an angry person, and I'm not. I'm trying to say to them, this is how this whole thing played out. I suppose my anger would be our continuing denial of crimes against children, our continuing denial.
I understand that, but where's the personal anger?
Where's the personal anger? I don't know. If you really push me, I don't know. All of these things you're asking me about are all the things that built into an experience that took me very, very close to serious mental health consequences.
Did you consider, you talked about having suicidal feelings. Did you have a method in mind?
I had, yes. Yes. But my problem was that I was not able to leave my daughters. All of those things that you're saying to me built upon an experience that took me very close. To really not managing this. So it was an absolute fight of my life, you know, to bring myself through this and to continue to function. And I suppose that's where I turned to education. This very strong desire I had for understanding, you know, took me then to the university and into psychosocial studies, which to me was a very powerful lens through which to begin to piece this thing together. And of course, you know, that takes me to the PhD, takes me to the book.
You mentioned Ed Balls, and in the book you say, once all legal proceedings were complete, I invited the head of Ofsted and the Ofsted board to discuss my findings. They declined. I also sought a meeting with Secretary of State Ed Balls, but received no reply. And going back to October 2013, after the compensation payout. And I wanted to ask you about this. This is really the only thing that's not in the book I want to ask you about. This is Ed Balls speaking on Radio 5 Live. Faced with the same situation, I would do the same thing again. And so, of course, the idea that Ms. Shoesmith walks away with a large amount of money sticks in the craw for me, and I think for millions of people across the country. I acted swiftly because public confidence demanded that I would do exactly the same thing again today, and the law required me to act swiftly in the public interest. Any thoughts?
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? He has to say that. What else can he say?
He could say, I screwed up, I'm sorry.
That's no, what, he couldn't say
that. Is that not what you want
that.
Him to say?
No, that's not what he was going to say. Of but, course he was going to say that.
What would
that.
You like him to say?
Well, at the time, he could have said there would be an investigation. Yeah. He would deal with that. There would be an investigation that would report back. He could have said that. I think he could have said much more to support the terrible horror that people were living with, yeah, on the news of Peter.
But this is much later. That's the point about this. This is October 2013. This is not in the heat of the moment.
Yes,
this
but
is
he's, after you. Yeah, he's not going to say anything else other than that, is he? I mean, he couldn't at the time. When he's under attack from Cameron and so on. He couldn't at the time.
No, I want to get into that because that's a very interesting
right,
area.
Okay.
I just, this business of much later, you know, people will have phoned him up and said, what do you think of this? This
yes.
is 2013. What would you have liked him to say at that point? If not the words he used.
It's typical. It's what a politician's going to say, isn't it? He still had to play into the narrative, hadn't he? He couldn't change his mind on the narrative. That wasn't going to happen, nor did I expect it to.
Gender became another submerged aspect of the narrative. At the press briefing, Collins and I, as Jane Collins, chief executive of Great Ormond Street Hospital, Collins and I presented ourselves as strong, decisive and resilient women. We each expressed sadness and regret at Peter's death, but we did not make any form of apology that may have given the sense of accepting responsibility for his death. Perhaps our professional attributes didn't convey enough feminine or motherly concern for those predominantly male journalists, and I was cast as a cold bureaucrat in ways that may not have occurred had I been male. Several months later, a journalist from The Guardian suggested that if I'd cried, things may have turned out differently. Could you just talk a little more about all of that and you being the wrong gender?
It's a very interesting part of the story. There's an interesting twist here, isn't there, that some elements of the public resent this, you know, this female, successful female, this supposedly high-earning female who will get much more criticism and ridicule than a male counterpart.
You spent some time in the book talking about David Cameron and the party politics that was going on at the time. He was trying to make his mark as a leader of the opposition, and the Labour Party under Gordon Brown were perhaps not doing as well as they wanted to. And the key paragraph I want to ask you about is this. Cameron, Brown and Bowles, I suggest, were all, by this stage, trading in untruths. This was not a case of Steiner's knowing and not knowing, which suggests an unconscious not knowing. But I argue they each chose to turn a blind eye to the complexity of what they were dealing with, given the coverage of the case in the media and the impact on the public. That's quite an accusation.
Yes. You can't tell me that Cameron, Bowles and Brown didn't know the incidence of familial child homicide. Certainly Bowles and Brown, well, Bowles would have known about the case of Peter. They knew what they were dealing with. Bowles would also have known, and one has to assume that Cameron would have had this knowledge, that 57 other children died the same year as Peter Connolly. And if you think back to that storm that blew up, there is absolutely no way that Ed Bowles could have gone on the television and said, now hang on, you know, 57 other children have died this year in the same way as Peter. I mean, that would have been tantamount to his own resignation, wouldn't it? Because it's so far away from the public knowledge of what happens to children. So he has to go and provide certainty. We'll make sure this never happens again. And indeed, by the time they were saying that, you know, something like another 50, 60 children had died in the same way. So they had to give the public certainty, which again is feeding this whole narrative of denial and denial. Yeah, they. I mean, Cameron.
What were his untruths?
Cameron's. Well, I mean, at one point he made the comment that, you know, 40 years ago, Maria Caldwell died. You know, we should have this should have stopped. And when I looked at the calculation around that, we were talking about 2,000 children having died from familial child homicide in that time. He talked about, this is the same borough in which Victoria Kalimbi died, but yet there were over 400 children in that period of time. And indeed, other boroughs and other places were a greater incidence of familial child homicide. So I'm not saying that this doesn't matter. I'm absolutely not saying that. I am saying the opposite. I'm saying this is a serious issue. And until we start to deal with it properly and recognise it and stop the blame process, because we're actually damaging the very professionals who we need to help us sort it out.
But with those, it's not my job to defend them, and I'm not, but to put a counter view to you, were they untruths they were telling, or were they... Were they being politicians in that they were omitting certain facts, painting the facts in a certain way? I mean, when I read that, I assumed you were saying, look, they know stuff and they're choosing to take that information and lie about it and tell untruths about it. Is that what they were doing?
Yes.
Or were they omitting stuff?
Well, I mean, people...
It might be a fine point.
Yeah,
but.
I mean, some people nowadays are using this term post-truth, yes. aren't they? We see this post-truth. Yeah. I mean, where does post-truth and lies, what's the difference? They were being politicians. They were surviving, to live for another day and see what happens next. That's what they do. When I went to court, what I received were things that were even more shocking than what I'd gone through already. So you get emails that are between top civil servants. I name them in the book. I'm not going to name them now. Top civil servants, the most senior civil servants, talking to each other about how they're going to cover up information that would actually go against that narrative that we were to blame. And how they would brief Ed when he faced the media so that he didn't let some of this stuff slip. So they knew what they were doing. And then you get the Ofsted inspection. I don't know whether you're going to come on to that, and I'll wait.
No, you go on.
You know, the 17 drafts of the Ofsted inspection were probably the greatest shock of it all for me. I mean, I always knew that the report that was produced was not reflective of the service. But again, it wasn't possible for me to go out there and say that. No one would have believed me. But when I saw how that had been edited and edited and edited and finally produced by Ofsted's top team and not by the other inspectors who came to Haringey. Now, that is one heck of a powerful statement to make, and I make it because I have the evidence for it. And I've had others look at the evidence and say, can I make this statement? Yes, I can. I've made that statement to Ofsted and they don't want to talk about it.
Would you like to have a chat with them?
Absolutely. This is the culture that we have produced for ourselves, that the whole country's shocked when they get news of how children have been abused over decades. Yeah, this is how we've got ourselves here, by this kind of behaviour.
I think the last bit I highlighted, and this, I suppose, brings us back to Rebecca Brooks. The interdependency of Brooks and Balls was evident in a phone call from Brooks to Balls, which during the Leveson inquiry, Brooks agreed had taken place. Brooks was asked, did you telephone Mr. Balls during the week commencing 17th November 2008, telling him to get rid of Sharon Shoesmith, or they would, quote, turn this thing on him? Brooks agreed that the call took place, but she denied using these words. She did agree the Sun was campaigning for my resignation and also that of others. What do you think of that?
Well, never in my wildest dreams would I ever have thought that the editor of the Sun could ring a Secretary of State. Yeah, I know different now. I've watched the Levinson inquiry all the way through. But when I was out there in the job, doing a very serious, hard job and working very, very hard in that job, I would never have believed, if you'd have told me that that was possible, I would simply have swept it aside, that that couldn't be possible, to order my exit.
Although she, at Leveson, denied using those words.
Yes. She had made the call. She made the call. And I look at some of these characters who are politicians and senior politicians, and I wonder, you know, what really...